Well, from the media center at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Pat Sullivan with another IndyCast, and I'm joined by famed motorsports writer Dave Argabright, who also does a tour of duty on the radio network. Dave, 500 is always exciting.
Extremely loose interpretation of the word famed there, Patrick. Yeah, this is great. I mean, I drove in here this morning. I had an early interview scheduled, and the sun's shining, and this is my first time out this week. I've been working on some projects and haven't been able to get out, but I'm here for the weekend now, and there's nothing like this place. I mean, I've driven through that tunnel like you many, many times. I still don't hesitate to get just a little bit of tingle when I come through there. Nothing like Indy.
One of the things you always try to capture are the personalities of the people involved in the sport. A little different world than perhaps 50 years ago, but some of these race drivers are still unique, and they're still at the core the same kind of character that we had competing here in years past.
I think probably, Pat, the difference is that it is, yes, personalities are different, but personalities are still there. I think the key difference is today's generation racer is conditioned to build a wall so that they don't let you really see what their personality is, and it's much more difficult to get people to open up. And the media access that we have here most generally is through press conferences and formal interviews, and very rarely do you truly see personality come out in that environment. You have to get behind the scenes a little bit. People let their hair down, and good and bad, that's where the personality comes out, and it's harder to get to here.
It's interesting because as we look forward, a Penske press conference has just ended. Tim Cindrics, whose father grew up in this sport as well. Tim was just talking about putting pictures of A.J. Foyt above his bed as a young man. So that passion is there still in some of the modern guys.
Yeah, mine was Farrah Fawcett probably more than A.J. Foyt, but I understand where Tim's coming from. He's exactly right. You know, there's something about racing, and particularly Indianapolis, that just reaches out to younger people and grabs them. It's so cool to see kids just become enamored with the Rick Mears in one generation and Sam Hornish in the next generation, and it's hard to describe how powerful that allure is, because that's something that to this day, I mean, even though I met him personally and got to spend a fair amount of time with him before he passed on a few years ago, Dick Gaines for me was larger than life. I mean, I just thought that guy as a sprint car racer was the pinnacle. And it was to this day, you know, all these years later, I'm still get excited when I talk about Dick Gaines, and that all stems from being a kid. That's what this sport and this place does so well. It lets a young person, their imagination just races away with them, and all the color and pageantry and excitement and drama. It really is capable of grabbing people forever if they open up and get exposed to it.
You were chatting with writer Bob Gates a minute or two ago, and I think as I walk through Gasoline Alley and I look at all the sophisticated equipment, the computer technology, the engineers, all this, you were talking about a moment when you visited Clint Bronner's garage in Phoenix. A little bit different, huh?
Yeah, that was in the, I guess that would have been the early 1980s, and Clint had pretty much retired from IndyCar racing, and I was just intrigued. I was out there. I had a sales career at that time, and I was intrigued by it. I'd read the book IndyCar Mechanic, or Indy 500 Mechanic, Joe Scalzo's book. Wonderful book, and Clint Bronner wrote that book with Joe, and I was captivated, and I really wanted to try to meet him. And when I was in Phoenix on a sales, I think it was a trade show or something, I actually went 2 days early with the specific intention of trying to track Clint Bronner down. And I somehow got a hold of him. He was in the book, and I called him, and he answered the phone at his shop, and he said, "Yeah, come on by." So I come over to the shop, and I've never seen anything like it. It was actually the shop that he built the Hawk in that won the 1969 Indy 500. But since that time, Clint had not been directly involved in IndyCar racing, and he had accumulated an incredible collection of old racing parts and stuff. Cars, rear axle, engine parts, wheels. The stuff was stacked up almost to the ceiling throughout this little shop. I'd say maybe 1,200 square foot shop. And I came in the back, and you're literally following pathways, trying to look for some sort of office or something, and I yelled out, "Hello," and so, you know, this older voice at the front, "Yeah," you know, and so here he comes, and he's got this crooked arm that's jutted out, and he had this funny-looking gait when he walked, and we spent most of the day together, and it was just great talking about Jimmy Bryan, but to this day, I don't think I'll ever forget that collection of stuff. It was the classic older guy who is just definitely going to go get around to building all this stuff one of these days, you know.
you grew up in rural Indiana, and you've chatted about, for example, if you went into a town like Pendleton, there would be a banner draped across the street proclaiming the activities here in Indianapolis.
The thing I remember most, and that's exactly right, Pat, growing up here in central Indiana, all the small towns around here would have banners, you know, for the 30 days of May and then the date of the pool day and the race day. And that was very common throughout Indiana. What I really remember, and this is honestly probably played a significant role in me becoming a lifelong race fan, when I was probably, it would have been the early to mid-60s, I was still just a very young kid. And all the local television station, in particular Channel 6 here in Indianapolis, it's WRTV now, but at the time it was WFBM-TV. And they had a show, it was a half-hour show, usually around 7:30 on a Thursday night, right before the track opened, narrated by Tom Carnegie, called Speedway Through the Years. And they took you through just an ongoing history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the Indianapolis 500, the film clips and a few little photographs, not a lot of interviews, but it was almost all archival film clips. And that really sparked an interest in racing history for me, because every year I look forward to that show being on. And I think it's a pity that we're not doing that now, because I can tell you directly, for me personally, that was responsible for a lot of my interest in auto racing.
The month of May is an entire experience, and you've had a close association with an event that occurs just before the 500, the Little 500 in Anderson, Indiana. That's quite a spectacular as well.
It is, Pat. It was started in 1949, sort of as an offshoot to capitalize on the success here, obviously. It's just a little quarter-mile track, but it's 33 sprint cars, and they start in 11 rows of three in tribute to the Indianapolis 500. And I would call it the most exciting 2 hours in racing. I mean, it's just pure action-packed drama, great racing, just really, really fun at a grassroots level. The good news is it's the night before the Indy 500. The bad news is it's the night before the Indy 500, and it makes for a very challenging week for me. I do some TV locally up there, and I wouldn't miss that race for the world, but I wouldn't miss this race for the world either, so it makes for a very short night that Saturday night and get up early and come down here. But, you know, you get through it because it's May, and you can sleep in June.
You can sleep in June. That's a good line. You know, one of the things that we've done this week is had a long conversation with a voice of the radio network, Howdy Bell. And I know the radio network, to all of us, was very important. It was a link for many of us between this racetrack, this event, and our homes, and we have fond memories of listening to those broadcasts.
You know, I came here, I was still, I don't think I was a teenager yet, in 1970 for pole day. We came in 68, I think, the day, that's right, when Jigger Sirois nearly got the pole. And it rained almost all day, and I almost don't count that because it was such an aberration. You know, we didn't see much racing. But in 70, my dad took me back here with some of his friends, and that was really cool. And so much of what I knew was from listening to the race all those years as a child on the radio, but also the TV program I described a minute ago. And the radio network, I currently serve as a pit reporter, and I remind myself sometimes that, you know, television has changed things, and television is truly worldwide and stuff and epic and all that. But, you know, there's still a whole lot of people who say to me all year long, hey, I heard you at the 500. People that I would never associate with being interested in the Indianapolis 500. But, you know, they might not make the trip to Indy, but they listen to it on the radio, and I think that's very cool.
And, of course, I know that you had an opportunity to do an interview with James Garner, and for you personally, that was a big thrill.
Jim Rockford, the Rockford Files. That was one of my favorite TV shows, and I met Jim here in the 80s. I mean, obviously, he wouldn't remember this, but he was here. I think he drove the pace car here in 85. It was a maroon-collar Olds Calais, and I'm pretty sure he was the pace driver that year, and he was happened to be sitting out on the pit wall one day, and I just sat down with him and chatted, and it was great. I mean, that's one of the cool things about this place, and that it attracts celebrities that we normally wouldn't even have the opportunity to possibly meet them. But here they are, and I think once they get here, something happens to them where the celebrity part is, particularly with Garner, who's an avid race fan, forget the celebrity part. He just wants to immerse himself with race people, and it's really pretty cool.
This race has had a variety of detractors, but you had a line a couple of years ago, and you said, I may not know better, but this still is about the biggest thing that happens.
Well, yeah, I mean, no matter what any detractor would want to say, show me something bigger. You know, show me something in the institution of auto racing that's been as enduring and as powerfully influential as the Indianapolis 500. And I don't care. There's just nothing else.
Emotionally, those moments heading towards the gentleman start your engines command is... It just kind of puts the hair on the back of your neck straight up, doesn't it?
Pat, really, if you're not moved by that whole period, I think, you know, maybe you need to seek some professional help because it's got a little bit of something for everybody. It's not just history and all of that, but for me, I think, personally, I get the most buzzed when they play Taps. They do when they do Back Home Again in Indiana, and not just from a racing standpoint. I'm a Hoosier native, and that song resonates with me. And then when the father gives the invocation and he says Godspeed in the many different languages, that is very moving to me. It's the dry eye is not to be found, I think.
Chatting with Bill Marvel, a gentleman we both know, he's now attending his 63rd Indianapolis 500, amazingly. And he said to me yesterday, you can say what you want, but nothing was better than last year's race, and that finish, that topped them all. And we could talk about the 60 race and some of the great battles, but that still is going to go down in lore as one of the classics.
I remember serving with the radio network, and we were basically down in the pit area, and I was standing at Michael Andretti's pit on that final lap. And they really felt that Marco was going to win the race. So did I. I didn't think Sam had a chance. And then right in front of us at the start-finish line, here comes Sam, and clearly he wins. And in such epic frustration, one of the crew members of Michael's crew slung his headset to the ground in disgust. Not in poor sportsmanship, but in pure unadulterated passion. You know, it just the disappointment was so profound for him at that moment, and the whole team and the whole family. And I instantly knew, Pat, I mean, I was cognizant of the fact that, you know what, I'm going to remember this moment for a very long time.
Yeah, they work an entire year and it comes down to 50 feet.
Sometimes as you're around this institution long enough, the years sort of run together and you say, what year was that? Oh, yeah, what? But when I'm old and gray, maybe I won't be able to pin the year down exactly, but I'll never forget that moment.
Marco Andretti in the press conference said, no one remembers who's finished the second. And I said, Marco, I think they're going to remember this one.
They will that time. I mean, it's like Gordy Johncock and Rick Mears in 82. You're going to remember the players in that sort of a shootout, no doubt.
Well, he's done a great job covering the sport both in word and in voice. Dave Argerbright has joined us on this IndyCast.